Hello, all you lovely bitches. How you doing? I'm Monica Estrella Negra, and this is another wonderful episode of Bitches on Comics. I am not the only one here. I am also joined by my beautiful, lovely, fantastic, intelligent, all the positive things, SC Fleenor.
And only 10 of the negative things.
Negative 10. Negative 10. Don't downplay my praise. Accept it.
I would never. I'm sorry.
In your right. Heart.
Thank you for
You're
the
welcome.
Love. It is so mutual, Monica. It is so mutual. I am just delighted to be here. I love Bitches on Comics. And I love you, Monica. I love you, Kate. I love everybody. I love everyone in the whole world, except for a certain list of motherfuckers who I Real. Do not love and in fact Real. Hate. Real. We're not going to talk about them today.
Because Not know today. What?
They have to live with themselves, and that's the worst punishment I can think of. So, booyah. What a weird intro. I am so excited to be here today. We have, such a great guest. It is the lovely Jasmine Walls. If you are not familiar with Jasmine, Jasmine is an award-winning writer, editor, and artist who is fresh off of her win for The Last Session, where the Colorado Independent Publishers Association gave it a gold medal. Uh-huh. Congratulations. That's so exciting.
Thank you.
Yay! And Jasmine is, in addition to The Last Session, the co-creator of Brooms and Vixen New York City, among many other titles, is busy, 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 always writing something. And we are just so excited that you made time for us today, Jasmine. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's always a delight. We did a written interview for Brooms when it first came out, and that was so much fun. And I'm so excited to actually like chat with y'all also. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. That was a delay. For listeners, you know, we talked to Jasmine and her co-creator, Teo Duval, about Brooms. And Priya was the one who talked with you also. I know that they really loved Brooms and they were like, can I do this interview? And we were like, hell yes. And, you know, I thought Brooms sounded so fun, but I didn't know I was going to fall in love with it. So, you know, we're hoping we'll have some time to talk about Brooms today. If we don't get to it, I will link in the show notes to Priya's exceptional interview that gets into so many cool parts of it. And it was so cool to hear from both Jasmine and Teo in that one. So super, super pumped. I can't believe that was already almost a year ago.
Right?
That blows my mind. I didn't realize it till just now. I was like, that was last October. I'm like, it's October. What am I doing? Like, it's still October. I guess you only come on the pod. You only come around in October. That's like your season for us.
Spooky season when I show up.
That's cool.
We love it. We love it. You know, I think a place I'd love to start, and, you know, I know a lot of interviews ask about this, but you'll have to bear with me, is I just want to know, like, where did your love of comics start? How did you get into this wild game? And I don't know. I think that's a good enough place to start.
Yeah, I would say in some ways it's a lot of thanks to my mother. So she's Belgian, and she grew up in Belgium and then came to the States where she married my father. And she's a huge fan of classic Belgian Bédés. So like Tintin, Lucky Luke, Asterix and Obelix, Marsupilami, like all the classics. She's a huge fan of them. She has a massive collection of them. And she loves them. And I grew up with that as a kid. And then my brother got really into sort of American comics, like your classic DC, Marvel. And I sort of fell off there because I was like, I wasn't super into the stuff he was reading. And I didn't really have money to buy my own. So I was like, well... But when I hit high school was when I realized, oh, they have some queer characters in here. So I began writing like essays on queer characters and when they began showing up in comics, and I began reading more widely in comics. And I stuck mainly to like DC, Marvel, and then I sort of fell off the wagon again because I was really focused on my baking career. I went to college for culinary school. I got a degree in culinary, specifically like pastry arts. And then I opened my own baking business, doing like specialty cookies and stuff. So if you ever see me posting about cookies, it's because I'm super intense about them.
I saw some you were working on. They looked intense.
Thank you. I have a lot of this time of year is when I really, really dig in on the cookies. And once I closed my cookie business, I had about a year where I was just like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'd spent like 7 years leading up to that business. And I was like, what am I supposed to do now? And then I remembered, you know what? The other thing I was thinking about when I was deciding which college to go to was comics. And I was like, okay, well, listen, comics aren't going to make me any money. I'll go to culinary school. And then I decided, I don't know, to backtrack and make less money later on. So I was like, let me try comics again. And I got really, really into indie comics. I realized there was this huge world that I had no idea about, that I had just begun learning about. And I was like, there it is. That's what I've been looking for this entire time. And that's why a lot of the mainstream comics haven't held on to me, is because it just didn't have that same energy that I find in indie comics, and didn't have the same kind of stories that I was looking for. But once I found that, I was like, there it is. Never going back.
That's awesome. So a lot of your influences came from exposure from your family. But mm-hmm. Well, first off, I want to say that Vixen NYC, I went back to a place of nostalgia because I went to Ghana in 2010. In 2010. And this was right on the heels of Obama's inauguration. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of fervor for first Black president of the United States. And there was merch. There was everything. It was pretty crazy. I still told everybody I was Canadian. but one of the best things that I did there is that I was able to tour some of the Asante kingdoms, their palaces, and also just discover more about the general history of Accra and how they defeated the British in colonization, and also some of the badass women that were part of it, Ya Asantewaa, and then also Kwame Nkrumah, and all of the work that he did with the proposed African-Arab union. And I'm just curious because I see some things within the Black diaspora, especially online, and lots of discourse between, the differences between Black Americans or mm-hmm. African Americans and other Africans in the diaspora who were not a part of the enslaved or the transatlantic slave trade. And I wanted to know, is there commentary on that specifically? Because I couldn't help but think that, her uncle, who thinks that he's the rightful owner of that, because, American, et cetera. Did you have that in mind when you were coming up with that? Or am I just reading too deep?
I didn't have that specific thing in mind. I did keep in mind the difference between the American Black diaspora versus the African diaspora that was not involved or not descendants of the transatlantic slave trade. Mm-hmm. And I did try to keep that in the story. I wanted the energy to be that she's definitely kind of a first or second generation. Mm-hmm. And I guess I didn't do it intentionally, but I'm glad that message came across. I did do quite a bit of research when I got into the story because I wanted it to feel real. I remember one of the very first notes that I put into the story was, we cannot fall into the same pit of depicting every single place in Africa as the same sort of yellow tinted, dusty, no.
Yeah.
Ghana's got huge cities. They're very metropolitan. We need to draw that. And so when you see her in the very beginning going to this huge airport, that's really gorgeous. You've got the, her grandmother's house. I was like, they're in a city. It needs to look modern. You can't just go with whatever stereotypes you're imagining for, all of Africa. A lot of comics unfortunately fall into that. Yeah. And I was like, no, we're gonna use actual references and we're gonna make it feel modern. So I did do quite a bit of research because I wanted the tone to feel right and the accuracy to be there. I didn't want it to feel like this sort of imagined stereotypical version of what could be anywhere in Africa, which happens a lot in comics where it's just a sort of vague assumption that we get in media. And I was like, no, we're going to use very specific things. And I wanted to, I'm glad it read that it kind of led into the culture as well, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. That the people also felt like not necessarily the same as, Black culture in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I went to school for African studies, so I always read into things.
I love it.
I'm just Charlie meme from It's Always Sunny, and there's a graph, and it's just that's me whenever I read.
No, I love it. I love it.
I'm like, but this has to be that and this, that. But yeah, when I saw like the image of Kotoka Airport, all I could think about was that feeling of like when I got off the plane and all I saw were Black people. As an African-American mm-hmm. woman that has grown up in the Midwest, I can tell you that that had never happened to me in my life before, mm-hmm. being in an exclusively Black country. Yes. So like, I also felt that excitement when she went to New York City and was just like, oh my gosh, like, look, there's like all this glitz and glam and da da da. And then she realizes that there's rats and like
trash
garbage
everywhere.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And I was like, oh my God, that was my first experience.
I was very
in New York
much
City
channeling
too.
My,
your
my
own private
experience. New York City.
Yeah, I'm just like, they put their garbage in front of their houses.
Right.
So like, how
does
it just
sit there?
Out? It just sits there and rots in the sun. But anyway, yeah. So it was like a lot. I felt like a lot of firsts, especially once like, you know, I wasn't talking to my family anymore and like was just kind of like exploring the States and like other countries, like, and just trying to find myself. I feel like that's like also a huge thing. And coming to age and like recognizing your ancestors and like the things that they went through and like how you got there. And so I just want to commend you on that because really made me feel warm and fuzzy inside.
I'm really glad that read across, because that was kind of what I think of as like the heart of the story, is this connection that she has to like her ancestral line, but also the connection she's building with all the people around her, you know, in her life.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I have to say that I cracked up at Batman's first entrance. I literally laughed out loud because I love to make fun of Batman a lot as a character, as an idea. But it was just like the perfect time, especially when like she had so many questions and he just wasn't there. And that was just like very, it was a very like honest, like guttural laugh. And I want to know, like, as far as like DC is concerned, what is your, like, how do you relate to any other supplemental characters that you had to write into? Or like characters that you've known of, and like, how did you like get into like that mind space of like creating like something that's unique to your own vision?
I see. Yeah. What I did was, when I picked up the project and discussed it with the editors and the project managers, we knew going in that we were kind of new to the Webtoon space. Mm. And they're like, okay, well, you know, the Wayne family one was doing really well. And they're like, all right, how do we kind of capture those same audiences and get that same vibe? And I was like, well, first of all, you have to understand that Webtoons fans love slice of life. Mm-hmm. So if I'm going to write this, what I want to do is have an equal amount of like action, like your DC fan action energy with the slice of life that is kind of the core of a lot of Webtoon energy. And that was kind of like the sort of lead that I was following for the entire story. Mm-hmm. And using that as my lead, I was like, okay, well, any characters that I'm introducing, how am I going to keep their unique personalities, but also make it fit the tone of the story? And so Batman is also a character who, I don't know if DC will get mad at me, he's also a character I love to make fun of as a concept. And so I knew that I wanted to sort of play on that. I wanted to have a little bit of that goofy angle. Like, the number of memes that I put into this script, I was just like, I don't know how to describe this, but like this energy. And for that scene, I was literally just slapped on the Beyonce meme. And I was like, this, whatever you need to do to get this energy, that's what I need right now. Because I remember, you know, he's a huge name in this universe. Like, this is a well-known vigilante. Yes, it's weird, but I feel like it'd be kind of like meeting Lady Gaga on the street. Like, if you had no context, if Lady Gaga was just a comic book character in your own universe and didn't exist as a real person, you'd be like, why would anybody be into this weird lady? But then, you know, you in real life, you're like, no, this is a celebrity. Like, it would be really kind of wild to just meet them on the street and be able to relate to them somehow. And I was like, that's the kind of energy I wanted to give it, where Mari's dealing with stuff that she's, you know, in a new city, she's about to get mugged. Something weird happened. Batman shows up in like a, just some grimy alley. How else can you react?
It's like, why are you in New York City?
And meanwhile, Bruce Wayne is on FNL. It's like, so funny. I died, Janet. That was so funny.
Yeah, it was, I love writing comedy. It's one of my favorite things to do. And I'm so glad it landed well.
No, it was perfect. I was cracking up. Especially when she was like, what are you doing? He's like, do you really want to ask that question right now? It's just like, well,
kind of.
Sort of. Yeah.
Like, well, now I think I shouldn't, but I kind of want to.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. No, it was great.
I'm glad.
Yeah, I mean, I think in that vein, it's a common thread in your work, and I think it's exemplified in Vixen NYC, is that ability to balance the comedic, the fun, the super quick pacing that I really feel like Vixen NYC had, that Brooms has, that really just sort of shuttles you along as you're doing this sort of slice of life moment. But then it's also balanced with really heavy topics, like Mari dealing with family drama that she inherited and family trauma that she inherited and family gifts that she inherited. I didn't plan that, but ooh, I like the way that sounds. Drama, trauma, gifts. I love it. You know, and I think I'm really curious for you, how do you find that balance between, let's just say, like the more the heavier and the lighter? Or is it not about balance? Is it actually they're two parts of the same thing? I'm curious.
For me, it's definitely kind of two parts of the same thing, because when in real life, one of the ways that I deal with a lot of things that are hard is I don't like to kind of simmer in bad feelings. To me, it's not helpful. And I don't know, I'm sort of like, if I'm not feeling productive, then I'm like, what am I doing? So I hate to like simmer in feelings that make me feel less productive. Like I have to be pushing for a solution somehow, some way. And sometimes the only solution when it's all just emotions is to kind of look for a silver lining. It sounds really cheesy. And I don't intend for it to, but I do try and find the most sort of earnest and the small joys that I can. And in my family, especially me, my siblings and my mom, we like humor. Humor's such a family coping mechanism for us. And it's a way for us to keep from just all kind of cycling these negative emotions back and forth, especially if it's, you know, if you've moved past the stage of being like, how do we sort of internalize this? You know, how do we express what we're feeling? Once you've moved past that and it becomes like, now we're just sort of letting negative emotions sort of sit in the air around us, even though we're not doing, like, there's nothing coming of it. We're not learning anything from it. We're not going forward. At that point, we're like, it's not going away. You know, things like grief or, you know, unfortunate life events, they're not going to go away. But if you can find a way to laugh together, it does make things more bearable. And that's definitely something that I sort of grew up with. And it's a way that I deal with things. So in my stories, I like to find a similar balance where I'm not shying away from hard topics, but I'm discussing them in a way that doesn't feel like, wow, this is going to be a real downer to kind of like sift through. I want to make it sort of relatable in a lot of ways, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, what you were just describing is exactly one of the other pieces I keyed into, because, you know, it's a lot of your work is about finding joy in the midst, forgive me, of, you know, hardship, loss, discrimination. You know, like, your characters go through hell. I don't think we could say any of your characters has an easy time, whether it be interpersonal or systemic or any other layer of what it is to be alive. But damn, do they love each other. Damn, do they create space for each other's pain or even slow each other down when... I remember there's this moment where, you know, Vixen's just like, well, and then this terrible thing. And then Karen's like, wait a minute. Let's like talk about it. Let's eat some food. I think you need a nap. Like, let's just be people, because it doesn't matter that we're super. We're also people. And that rings so true in my experience of what it means to be in community with other marginalized people. Like, Monica has more than once been like, we need to slow down. We need a break. We're only human. Mm-hmm. You know, when we talk behind the scenes at BOC, we're like, nothing we do is emergency level. No mm-hmm. one should be getting hurt to make an episode of a podcast happen. You know, like, and I think that
That is so real. And you talk about community just a little bit in your acknowledgments for Brooms. And I'm curious if you could expand on sort of what you said so far and tell us a little bit more of what is that role of community in your writing, and maybe how does that connect with the joy and mm-hmm. the gravity? Like,
yeah, pretty much everything I write is going to involve community at some level, even if it's just two people finding a way to work together. Or in Brooms, where you have this team that, you know, you have some people who've known each other and you've got some new elements, and then you've got this larger community that they're a part of. How they rely on each other, how they interact with each other, how they've built a space for each other. Or in Vixen, where it's very much she's building this found family, learning who she can rely on, who she can't rely on, kind of making her way through all these tough life choices. And even the not tough, like the easy choices, but like who is she going to share those choices and those, you know, the energy with. And to me, that's really important in any kind of story I make. I love talking about interpersonal relationships, community, found families, blood families, whatever ties you find joy in. Circling back to the, you know, finding positive things in dark situations. For me, I think that's the only real way forward. It's so easy to get caught up in all the worst things and to sort of just make that your entire life, only focusing on the bad things. And I think there's nothing to really gain out of that. It's important to acknowledge them, but it's just as important to say, how can things get better? And if you don't imagine anything better, how can you possibly build it? And when I began writing, when I began taking picking up like actual publishing deals, one thing I noted to myself as like a career goal is that I said, I don't ever want to work on struggle stories. And I always capitalize that as like the struggle type stories when they're there and they're always a downer. It's like, to me, it feels like let's explain racism to white people kind of stories where it's like, wow, this is really horrible. Here's some really vicious imagery of like horrible things happening to people of color. And I'm like, that's not for me. Those are not for me. This is trauma for me. And I want to make stories that don't ignore those issues. I'm not writing historical fiction that conveniently erases all these issues. But I want to show that, like, if life had been nothing but pain, if life had been nothing but horrible things, why would we have fought so hard to survive? It's all about the small joys. It's about those small joys. It's about those communities you build that other people might not acknowledge or know about, but they are there. And that's how you make it through. And I'd much rather focus on those stories than just straight up struggle stories. I hope that answered. I feel like I went.
No, that's absolutely real. I think about the saying, you know, we laugh in order to keep from crying. And mm-hmm. I definitely try to embody that as much as possible. Just because, you know, Black joy is a very important thing to me. Queer joy is a very mm-hmm. important thing to me. Like any type of joy by any marginalized group, I feel is a method of survival.
And it's its own form of rebellion.
Exactly. And mm-hmm. it doesn't mean that, like, because I also, as a filmmaker, I made a conscious decision that I will never show Black people being killed in mm-hmm. my movies. And I make horror movies, but mm-hmm. I like explicitly go out of my way to make sure that there is no like violent traumatic death, because you go on social media whenever there's like a Black person killed by the cops or like, you know, anything that happens to our communities, like the videos are there. Like they're just like coming down like your mm-hmm. algorithm like all the time. Why do we need to do that like in the stories where we're trying to like uplift ourselves and represent ourselves?
Yes. You know,
there is a time and place for like this documentation. Like I agree with you. Like there is, we should not just ignore mm-hmm. the bad things that happen because we actively have to figure out how to, you know, sustain ourselves and defend ourselves, et cetera. But like also we should make like equal lengths of just like showing that like, you know, we live, we love, we laugh, mm-hmm. you know, et cetera, like all those things. I think I was about to sing the L Word theme song, but I kind of cut myself. Is it like live, laugh? I don't know.
Living, for some odd reason, that's just breathing.
I was ready.
I am so sorry, guys. Do that
I
again.
Love it.
But anyway, but you get what I'm saying. I'm just saying, I agree. I wholeheartedly agree.
That's it too, is I think I had these as two different questions, but I think they're going to be one question. Let's see if I have, you know, Am I back in full form? Can I do it? Let's find out together. One thing that really stood out to me, not just in Vixen NYC, though it's there and it is the thrumming heart of the story, in my opinion, but in all of your work is the banal, quotidian queerness. It is just like, there are just gay people. What do you want? They just exist. They're in the background. People just use they, them. It's just, it's this, I think it could almost go unnoticed because it's so effortless. But for me, it feels like a hug. And so it stood out so much. If I cry, I swear, I will just fire myself. No one can fire anybody here. It's chaos. And that's why we have fun. I was so excited when you introduced the Queer Youth Center as one of the settings. It not only expanded Grace Choi's character and her background. Oh my God, how dare you design the hottest Grace to ever have appeared in a comic? I'm offended. You have to thank
Mano for that.
Mano killed it. Way to go, Mano.
Incredible designs all throughout the entire series.
So good.
So good.
Mano Azumi, right?
Yes.
I want to make sure I got it right. Yeah, I was so pleased. And the ability to sort of, like you said, really give that slice of life art, that really intimate sort of you're in the everyday. And then, you know, to mix in the chibi and to mix in the like little moments of almost, you know, like news comic strips from newspapers and, you know, and then just straight up classic pop art, you know, like such a beautiful, in a way, almost like a lesson in comics in itself. If you really can trace, you know, the different art styles, just truly amazing. Same with Brooms. So moved by some of the panels there and some of the artwork there.
I've been very lucky working with just so many cool teams.
They
and
get
so
you.
Many cool artists, and it's just like people are like, "Oh, what is your dream?" I'm like, "I literally every single project I get to work on is like a dream project. I'm so excited about all of them."
Yes, well, and you can see that, you can really see that. But I think what I thought specifically about the youth center and the queerness is, it starts out as sort of like a background setting, right? It's just like, oh, just so happens that's where Grace is. And it's like, oh, it just so happens that's who can help the girls who've been kidnapped. Oh, it just so happens, which is what queer youth centers are. They just so happen to always be right where queer youth are. I wonder why. But then you also bring in this moment that's really important for Mari as she's trying to connect with Anansi, the god who gave her the totem. And she has to choose a place of transformation, something that would appeal to the trickster, something very emotional, crossroads, all of that. Oh, I have chills. I have chills. And she chooses the Queer Youth Center. And then he shows up and he's like, "You chose well." And it moved me. I'm in tears, obviously. But I want to know why it was important for you to take this figure of African myth and to show him at home in the presence of queer and trans people. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, there's several reasons. On one hand, especially specifically in the African American community, homophobia is still a huge issue. Just like mental health is still a huge issue. It's something that's not super talked about. And if it is talked about, you can get, depending on where you are, some places are cool. A lot of places, like a lot of my family's from the rural South, and they are not okay with a lot of things. And it's such an interesting dynamic where you have these very kind of liberal ideas about, you know, because of their own trauma, like freedom for everyone, like we need to fight back against racism, against classism. But then you have people who are really intense about like their transphobia, their homophobia. And it's painful. It's really painful. And I wanted to have this really iconic and really beyond iconic, but like genuinely a part of people's beliefs, this deity to say, "I'm cool with this," because I cannot imagine Anansi not being cool with it. I feel like if there's any sort of figure who would be like, "Yes, I'm down. I'm here for you." Like, why wouldn't it be Anansi? And I really wanted to show that dynamic and make it be like, there's no hesitation. He loves this place. He puts his symbol on the building and is like, "I'm going to watch over this place because I love it so much. This is great." And that was a really important one for me. I wanted to have this larger than life figure who does not hesitate to support these groups that aren't necessarily getting the support in their daily life.
So thinking about Vixen NYC, thinking about Anansi, thinking about Grace Choi, thinking about Anissa. I mean, you were packing the queerness in and just like that the youth center, it just keeps going and going. And I love it so much. You know, people who love people of the same gender. Again, Grace Choi and Anissa, such a iconic sapphic couple and rendered so tenderly and sexily in Vixen NYC. I think I can say that about Grace Choi, at least. I think she's old enough in this. And, you know, it's so delightful. And I'm curious for you, you know, how have you navigated writing queer and trans stories in the current anti-all things queer environment that we're in? And with your work for Higher Work in particular, and if we end up saying anything we have to cut, we'll cut it. I'm curious if there was pushback or how much you had to advocate for bringing your queerness, if I may, into your stories and bringing a much broader umbrella of queer and transness into your stories.
Yeah, I've been incredibly lucky so far in my career. I've had very little pushback. And some of it is that like I've worked with really great editors and people who are really open to the stories I want to tell. And also, I feel partly because if you look at my website, the stuff that I have on there, I'm like, listen, you knew what you're getting when you hired me.
And I have. And I have looked at your website.
It's not subtle in the slightest. I mean, one of the first things you see on my illustration page is a bunch of cowboys and Daisy Dukes in high heels. Like, you knew what you're getting into when you hired me. And at the same time, usually very early on in a project, when I'm talking with the editors, especially for Higher Work, when I'm drafting the story, I'll ask them, hey, how queer can we make this? Like, when I worked on the last session, one of the first things I asked them, I was like, can I make every single one of these characters queer? They're like, sure. And I was like, cool. They're going to start out in a failed GSA club. And then for Vixen, I specifically picked characters because I think when I started out, they told me the three characters they really wanted to see were, of course, Mari. And then they wanted Beast Boy in there. And they wanted Batman to show up. Outside of that, they're like, let us know who you want to have in the comic. We'll see if we can get the licensing rights for them.
And, okay, because I did have a follow-up question about your secondary cast, because you were like, baby, let's do Bumblebee, let's do Thunder, let's do Raven, let's do John Jones, let's do Starlight. I mean, it was so fun that way. I kept being surprised by, oh, that's Bumblebee. And I was a little spoiled because I love the comments on Webtoon. I can't help myself. People are so cute. And they get so excited to be like the top comment and stuff. So, I mean, and even, this is a tangent, but Monica and I were talking about, you have a lot of followers for Vixen NYC on Webtoon. People really love it.
I can't really look at comments since I'm the one writing it. So
of course
I try really hard not to look at
I won't tell you anything anyone said except everybody loved your secondary cast. And that's how I knew who Bumblebee was early. I was like, oh, right, that is Bumblebee, isn't it? It was just, I don't know. I didn't mean to throw you too far off. But
no.
This was one of the things I wanted to hear about was how you chose these characters and how much leeway you had.
And Bumblebee was also one of the people that they had wanted early on. And then it was up to me to decide how I wanted to build that cast, if there are any other characters I wanted to bring in, and if there are any characters I wanted to create from scratch. And so I was looking through, and I was like, I want a really good couple of mentors for Mari. And so I was like, I want Grace Choi, because I was like, why wouldn't we give her a cool buff lesbian mentor?
Obviously.
Obviously. And then I was like, I mean, if we're going to have Grace, you got to have Anissa there. And one thing I really wanted is I wanted them to feel like a really healthy couple. I feel like their story often gets, you know, a fair amount of like perfectly valid drama. Like comic books are always going to have drama and very interpersonal drama. But for this one, I feel like there's so much outside stuff happening. I wanted to really give them like a sturdy anchoring relationship. That's like a good point for this entire like storm of their life to smash up against. And then they hold strong. And that's something I like to do in a lot of my stories, like in Brooms with Billy May and Luella, same situation. I really like having these like really strong relationships who hold up against all these outside forces rather than focusing on like drama that breaks people up and gets them back together over and over again. And I think that is part of that sort of casual queerness that comes in. is they're just there. They're just there and they're solid couples. Oftentimes they're already established. That way they can kind of face these challenges together. And that's, I really like writing that. And then we had, Anansi is a shapeshifter. And I was like, why would I stick Anansi with a single gender? It's Anansi. They don't care. No. They can take whatever form they feel like taking that day. And like, power to them.
Oh, and I love that bonus content when they're like, oh, we want to be respectful, Anansi. Like, what pronouns do you use? And he was like, come on. I guess he, him. But like, what are pronouns, baby? And I was like, that's my guy. Exactly. my non-binary, non-gendered guy. That's him.
Yeah, he was a lot of fun to write. And then the only character, probably like main character that is now inside of a sort of DC like wiki page that I created was Stardust, who is the non-binary person with a mutation that turned them into like a gaseous form. And then I want a cool robot mech person.
Well, and then, you know, and then Stardust gets that new, mm-hmm. you know, suit that is more like, I would say like androgynous a little bit more. It has like some femme edges to it, mm-hmm. which I think is so nice.
Yeah.
I really love Stardust. What an entry to get. Wow.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I wonder what it'll be like one day when someone grabs Stardust for one of their team ups and you're like, that's my girl. That's my non-binary girl. You know, like that's her.
I hope so. I think it would be really fun to see them again as long as no one hurts them.
You really so they didn't did. Have to fight.
And I like doing that too, where it's like some people don't necessarily want to have to put their life on the line all the time. They were just in unfortunate circumstances. And I like the idea that being in this sort of superhero universe means that they can find a less violent life that they can live. Yeah, so I think we wandered a little bit, but yes, I do really love having very casual queerness in my worlds. I want them to feel very integral, and because they are. Queer people have been around forever, as long as people have been around. Mm-hmm. And that will always be a part of my story. So I've been very lucky not to get a lot of pushback. Mm-hmm. Usually I'm working with very cool editors and very cool publishers who are like, go nuts. And I'm like, you gave me too much freedom, but I'm going to go for it.
That was just the invitation I needed.
Exactly.
And that type of like representation, especially for marginalized people in spaces where like we are not usually seen or even just like existing in society, is so important. Because I mean, every time there's like a major like event that happens about like, you know, trying to get rid of people or like trying to take away their rights, the first thing that they do is always attack the history. Because mm-hmm. if you don't know your history, then you have no validation about your own existence in your mm-hmm. present time. As far as Brooms is concerned, was that like your main like objective was just to like present that of like our community's existence and how we will always exist and just like how histories will vary depending on who has the power to define historical moments?
Yeah,
or like
very much so. I mean, on one hand, I just wanted to tell a fun magic racing story. On the other hand, I didn't want to flinch away from these historical truths, while also presenting a side of those bits of history that people so rarely focus on, which is like the small pockets of community and joy and like family building and support for each other that people build for each other in these communities, whether they be like whatever form of marginalization it's focused on. And I really wanted to really let that shine, because, and partially out of spite, like I'm going to be real, the number of stories about witches that all take place in Europe with all white casts in some sort of bougie magical school. I was real tired of it. And every time it mentions America, it's like, for some reason, it's either going to be like 1920s New York, or it's going to be something else. And it's never a decent representation. Or I'm sure there are some that I have not read, but the ones that are mainstream, I'm going to say the ones that are mainstream are usually
I was about to say, we will not name not certain great. People.
We know the names.
We know the name. We know the name.
We don't need to say it, but you know.
Yeah. Off mic, we will go through the list. We'll be like, starting with.
And so, yeah, it was definitely a little bit of spite where I was like, why are we not getting cool stories about the people who aren't necessarily going to these magical academies. Like, what happens to all the people who don't get invited? And that's why you only ever hear in Brooms, I made a point to never see a magical school on page. The only school that you see on page is the one that Luella gets dragged off to against her will. Mm. And that was very much done on purpose. I wanted to show instead a community of people who are building this sort of collective knowledge by sharing it with each other willingly and freely and taking what they need from it and then using knowledge from their own family, their own cultures, as opposed to some like a very rigid structure of a school.
Well, in that vein, I think one of the reasons Brooms works so well is it resists this tendency, I think, in talking about magic and witches and magical schools, which is to say things work this way. Mm-hmm. And then they do, which is not reality, right? Like, we all went to schools and people told us things worked a certain way. Mm-hmm. And then we entered the real world in some context or another, sometimes while we were still children, sometimes later. And we say, well, that doesn't fit the textbooks. That isn't what my teacher told me the world would be like. And there are always alternative histories. There's always alternative stories. There's always alternative subcultures. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it was just like a hug to not have all the spells be in Latin, to have them be in various languages, to have conversations be in various languages. And that resistance to the white supremacist hegemony of the white supremacist magic schools in your book, it's not just brilliant for what it does in the story, but it's brilliant for how it, A, comments on 1930s Mississippi in real life, right? But also how it reflects back reality right now in the United States. I think it's encouraging. I think, to your point, you said, you know, I wanted to write something fun, but I think the way that you say, okay, if I was going to, I mean, you would have to if you were going to dig into those magical schools. You would spend a lot of time writing about white people, right? And like, you did enough. You put enough white people on the page for us to get the stakes. But we get to have fun. I think at the top of the interview, I mentioned that I had read somewhere that Brooms was compared to the Fast and the Furious. And when I read that before I read Brooms, I was like, okay, maybe, like, we'll see. And then there's one point where Billy May is talking shit. And then, like, you know, and then there's like sick turns and like sudden spells no one saw coming. And I was like, this feels like the Fast and the Furious in the best ways, in the best ways.
'Cause family.
You know what? I did say, in my head, I was like, the only part that was missing is if Billy May at one point had screamed, family, then, like, you know, it would have really, but that would have been too much.
If you're a fan of the podcast and want to hear even more excellent interviews, get sneak peeks into everything else we're up to, and be the first to know what's up with the lovely bitches, we hope you'll join us on Patreon at patreon.com/queerspec, where we already have hundreds of bonus episodes and other content and add more every month, usually.
It's even in really hard times. And Brooms is definitely, probably like, definitely like a shining light example of doing that. I'm really proud of how that story came out. I'm really glad that we got Teo agreed to work on this book with me. He did an absolutely incredible job depicting exactly the mood that I wanted, and adding adding so much extra to every single page. Like, the book just wouldn't be at all the same without him. And I think that's something I like to carry through all the work I do. You see a little bit of it in Vixen, where she's facing these really hard choices. But I'm going to break it up with a little bit of like a lightheartedness, because she also needs to just be a college kid. And then the same thing with the last session, which is definitely lower stakes. But you have these friends who, you know, when it's happening to you, like, friendship breaking up is a hard thing. At the same time, I wanted to have that same balance where it's like you have that drama, but you also have the lightheartedness. And then Brooms in particular is heavily influenced by my own family and the struggles that they went through. My family on my dad's side, which is from the Deep South, were so very close to getting trapped in sharecropping. Like, one generation ago. It's wild how recent this stuff is and how just insidious it is and how much it can ruin generations afterwards. And I wanted to capture that in a way that felt like still like a love letter to my own family.
Have you ever read the book Tituba by Maurice Kondé? It was written in 1986, but it's a fictional book that is seen from the point of view of Tituba. And that was definitely the vibe that I got when I read Brooms. But this is not like a struggle story, struggle TM story. It's more so about, you know, we're not focusing on the Puritans and like the crucible, like whatever. Mm-hmm. This is solely from like her journey from the islands into like New England or whatever, the new colonized land. And the witchcraft that she does is not necessarily witchcraft, but it's more directly tied to traditional African spiritual practice. So like voodoo, stuff like that. Stuff that was, you know, not necessarily witchcraft in the form of like whatever the colonizers were saying that it was, but she was doing stuff to actually like help. So her knowledge of herbs, her knowledge of like how to get rid of sickness or whatever. And then she's ultimately persecuted for that because she like teaches like the young girls like how to do like things. And I couldn't help but think about like, you know, how it is up to us as like creators to create like our own narratives, because it's so easy for us to either be erased or to have us misrepresented. And my family also like hails from the South. Like they were definitely a part of the great Black migration that happened. My mom was born in like a really small town in Mississippi where sharecropping like was the thing. Like it literally went like abolishment of slavery to, yeah, we'll pay you like some pennies to do like the same thing, but pretty much like indentured servitude, I would want to say, something that was not afforded to enslaved Africans at that time. But, you know, also for poor like whites, they were able to get paid for the work that they were doing and also the possibility of being freed. So I just want to commend you because I absolutely just appreciate any narrative that doesn't necessarily show us as like the victims of our circumstances, but showing us as the victors, liberating ourselves and being able to retain this resilience in order to consider to continue existing. So I just wanted to give you props on that.
Thank you. And that's exactly what I was hoping to do. So I'm really happy it came through that way.
This is a place I see it dovetail with our conversation about Anansi and Vixen, is this unrelenting commitment to telling the truth, which is that queerness in Africa predates colonization, that queerness in Africa, the queerness around the globe predates colonization, right? That's a fact. You can't convince me of anything else. I know how facts work, you know? That's a fact. You know, that queer people have found ways to live in every society under colonization too, right? Like that's the other piece Brooms brings to the table, that is under enslavement. There are queer people. Of course, you can't get rid of us. You could try, but we're going to keep being born. It's going to keep happening because we are a natural, beautiful expression of what it means to be alive on this planet. You got gay frogs. You can't untrans the frogs. You can't untrans the fishes. You can't make these chickens stop fucking each other. You know what I mean? Like, y'all are crazy. And you think it's not going to be the people too? You think, really? Come on. And it's, I think that sort of, again, that unrelenting commitment to the truth of the global South, the truth of Black people on this planet, the truth of Indigenous people on this planet, the truth of trans people and queer people on this planet. That's what makes your work make me say, fuck yeah, comics, fucking rule. You know, like getting to see Vixen have this conversation with Anansi where she feels connected to a long history she's been divorced from through her parents' immigration. To some degree, you know, she didn't know her uncle. You know, now she's coming back to these things with all the beauty and all the pain and Brooms, these people who have been pushed to the margins so purposefully by white people, who have been punished, have had their magic taken from them, have had to live in fear, hiding dresses so they can be their true selves. all of that, every time you put those things on the page, to me, it's exactly what Monica was saying, which is you say, we were here, we are here, and we're not going to go anywhere. And our stories, they can be super fucking funny. They can be super fucking sweet. They can be super tender, and they can be super racy. I actually mean in the literal sense of a race. I don't even mean like sexy, but yes, that too. They can be both. You know, there's so much more that can be done. And I think I'm just so moved by, and if this sounds patronizing, tell me and I will shut the fuck up, but by someone so relatively early in their career, because you have a lot, you've done a lot, but you know, like you're not N.K. Yeah. Johnson, you're not Kelly Sue DeConnick, but you're still putting all that on the page in the same way you were like, well, they saw my website, you know, that carefree, because you can't take it from me. That comes through so beautifully in all of your work. And it makes me, again, I guess, just feel like, fuck yeah, comics, man. Can't we do some cool shit in comics? Like, I don't know if a broom racing Fast and the Furious would work in a lot of other genres. I mean, I could see it in a novel. I could see it in a movie. But on a comic, there's just the little tiny smirks, you know, that we get to spend time just pouring over. All the different little interactions, even the sign language, I think about a lot. It really does lend itself to this form. And I'm curious for you. Curious for you, when you think about brooms, because is it a year old now, right? It's a year old.
Yeah.
When you think about it a year in, what are the things that stand out to you? Like, what are you proud of in it? Or we've talked a little bit about that, about putting your family on the page. And that was so cool. I'm hearing that like brought tears to my eyes. I was like, that's so beautiful. But I'm curious, you know, what makes you proud of the piece? In terms of like maybe reception, have you had a chance to talk to people who read it? In terms of, you know, I think, again, you and Teo really were quite the partnership. It really feels like you managed to translate things to the page in a really powerful way. But, and then I guess, like, is there anything that you would want to change either about, you know, the experience around the book or in the book itself? A year in, like, what are your reflections? Talk to me.
For sure. Actually, something you said just before that I want to touch on real quick, because you mentioned that these stories can be funny, and it reminded me that a lot of people, especially queer writers or queer artists or comic makers or any other kind of marginalization, are leaning a lot into horror. And that's something I've noticed, is expressing a lot of that pain through horror. And you can, in so many ways, where it's like, this is just a manifestation of the pain, so I can put it out in the world. Or we're going to make ourselves the victor of these horror stories rather than the victims, which I love. And I feel like I have that same urge. I just go in a different direction where I want to make these fun stories that end well. And it's that exact same response, just with different genres. And I always find it really fun. But to actually answer your question, a year in, it's still wild, because sometimes people will be like, what's your dream book? And I'm like, Brooms was my dream book. I got incredibly lucky that it was the very first book I signed. It's not the first book that came out, but it is the very first book that I signed on with a publisher. I had just the wildest streak of luck. I emailed Teo at 2 a.m. feeling brave, and Teo responded and was like, this sounds fun. And I was like, whoa, not actually expecting a yes, but I'm certainly not going to turn it down. Because at the time I was very unknown. I mean, I'm not super well known now, but I was very unknown at the time. And then me and Teo were discussing like the pitch and who else we'd want on the team. And we listed our, you know, number one dream team. And we got everyone. We got every single person who was our top choice. We got Ariana Mayer. We got Dexlin Dining. And like, when does that happen? What are the chances we were going to be that lucky? So even now, a year in, hopefully 10 years in, I'll still be like, just sort of amazed at how incredibly just like lucky we were to all have exactly the right timing to get the editors we wanted, the publisher we wanted, the entire team that we were hoping for, and really make this book exactly what we wanted it to be, which is very rare, especially in comics. It's very rare you can do that. So I'm really happy about that. I'm still, whenever I think about it, I get jazzed up when I think about brooms. But I'd say one of my favorite things that's come out of it is how many libraries and librarians and teachers like this book. And that's what I wanted from the get-go. I didn't want this to be a book that only comics people knew about. And my goal, and I told this to the publisher, everybody on the team knew, what I really wanted was to get this into the hands of people who don't necessarily have access to know what new comics are coming out, who go to libraries a lot because they can't necessarily afford to buy all these books on their own, who find the book in their school. I wanted it to get into the hands of marginalized kids. And the fact that it's doing so well in libraries, and a lot of teachers have come up to me at conventions and been like, oh, they'll walk by the table and point at rooms and be like, I love that book. And that gives me such a good feeling that librarians and teachers have this book in their classrooms. And to me, that means that kids who need to read this book are reading it. And that means a lot to me. And I guess anything I'd improve. I mean, as a writer, and you're right, I am still pretty early in my career. Every time I make a book, I feel like I improve a little bit on my writing. I learn more. And I feel like it's always going to be that thing where when I look back, I can see what I could have done better. But I try not to linger in that feeling, because I am really proud of the books that I put out. And at the time, that was like my top level that I was at. So I can look back and I can see the things I can improve, but I try to be happy that someone thought I was good enough to like take the chance on me and put my books out. And I do my best not to like disrespect that by being like, oh, I was terrible then, because clearly they thought it was good. I want to respect that. And anyone who's enjoying the books, find something good about my writing. So even when I'm feeling really down, I try to remind myself that like it's no good to anyone to put myself down with stuff that I've published. But I can always strive to be better. So yeah, when I look back and I see flaws, what I do is I'm like, okay, well, moving on. I'll try to avoid that or do that better.
I love artists. I love talking to artists. All of us are so funny. Oh, we're like, oh, I know I could change some things. And it's like, babe, brooms rules. Like, I don't see the flaws, and I'm not exactly the nicest person. I'm a critic, you know, like it's my job. I'm sure they're there, you know, and I can understand why you feel that way. I think, you know, when I asked the question, I was more thinking about the process, because I didn't realize that you got your number ones on everything. Like that makes me feel happy, because I'm like, if anybody, like if any book deserves the magic touch, like, isn't it brooms? Isn't it like
the
story
so.
Of these like underdogs and they're like broom racing team? It's just, it's so fun.
I've also
so
made
good.
Really good friends. After the, I still talk to everyone on the team. I'm working on hopefully future books with these people. So yeah, I mean, it was a big launch for me in so many more ways than just the book.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I feel like it had a good reception.
Yes.
And I think continues to be one that I see people talking about, because I think brooms is so, it's all the things, right? It's like, it does important historical reflections. It's really, really fun. It's diverse in like the best and most possible way, right? Mm-hmm. You know what? Actually, I totally feel like this is like concluding language for us talking about brooms. And now I'm like, wait, I have one more thing about brooms. Which is fat people. I love fat people. I love fat people. And it's so nice to see Billy May is not small. Billy May is a big person on that broom. And none of it is like, well, bigger people would fly slower. It's like, of course they wouldn't. It's magic. Like, what are you talking about? But I mean, people can't help themselves. Fat phobia works its way into so much of our art, so much of our politics, our baseline conversations. I mean, I can't think about that. Our healthcare system. Okay, not going to talk about that. But, you know, for you, I'm curious, you know, in that character design, which obviously is always a team effort with Teo in this case, or whoever the illustrator is or the artist is, depending on how it's labeled on the book, right? But, you know, what was key for you in getting fat people on the page? And are you happy with how you did?
Yeah, and it's something that I try and do with every project. I always, whenever I start a project, I always try to have a conversation with the artist to say, I want to see body diversity. I want to see people on a range. And I also want to see, I love having representation of disability. I feel like it's really important. It's just as important as having queers on the page for me, because it's a part of our lives. And creating media about like everyday people that doesn't include that just doesn't make sense to me. And for Billy May in particular, this is very much an admission on my part. I was creating a character that I could cosplay. I have the exact same ponytail she does. I literally, her body type is my body type. I was like, I want to be able to dress up as a character. I was like,
is that like the single greatest flex you could have as a creator? Yeah. Like, I created my own cosplay by making a badass black woman. Like, don't even. I love it.
Yeah. And Teo was fantastic. I mean, I mentioned it once in the very beginning. I gave Teo descriptions of all the main characters. And then Teo, except for Billy May. Billy May is the only character I drew a sketch of, because I was like, I'm going to make this cosplayable character that I can play. And then outside of that, I just wrote descriptions of the main cast for Teo. And Teo did an incredible job taking that on and designed absolutely amazing characters. And then went beyond that. So if you look in any of the crowd scenes, you're going to see such a diverse array of people. And it's one thing that I really, really admire about Teo and his art is just, there's so much care that goes into every single aspect. No matter if you're just like a centimeter tall on the page, it's going to look good. And I love that. And then we try to do the same thing. It was a little bit tougher in Vixen. We were kind of confined to like pre-known characters.
Sure.
And so it was a little bit tougher, but I did want to at least talk a little bit about disability, which comes up. And like, a lot of it comes up in the sense of like these metaphors of hatred against these people with mutations. And for me, that was a little bit trickier. I like to be a little more direct. But I think we still managed to get a decent amount on the page. And then in the last session, we also, when I talked to Dozer also is just, I've just been able to work with just incredible teams on every single one of these projects. So I'm always really happy. And Dozer's also just beyond amazing. And when we were designing the crew for the last session, I said, I do want diverse body types. And Dozer's like, got you. And she's delivered. Just delivered amazingly. So I've been really lucky. And it is something that when I start a project, I go in and I say, I want that diversity. I don't want to just see the same two body types for every single person in this comic. I don't find it interesting. I want to reflect like real people.
Well, it is much appreciated. I can say that for myself. And I'm so glad you brought up disability. That did really stand out to me. Even in the metaphors, like, I got it. I got it. You know, it was there. It was there.
Do you like scary movies? Sydney Prescott doesn't, but Sarah Century does. That's me, Sarah Century, and I'm here to tell you about my latest zine, which is titled Scream, an overview of the first six films. I was 13 when the first Scream hit theaters, and it was a huge deal. Since then, Scream has become a franchise with many sequels, and I have also become a franchise with many sequels. This lengthy personal essay clocks in at around 15,000 words, and it comes with a hand-printed rubber-stamped cover. Physical copies are limited to 250, each numbered on the inside cover, and when they sell out, they're gone. There is also a PDF that will be available indefinitely. Scream, an overview of the first six films, ships out on September 2nd, and it's available for pre-order now at sarahcentury.gumroad.com. Go ahead and follow the shop, because there are several more releases to come in the following months. And thanks. Thank you. Thanks.
And she's always so good at that. Listeners couldn't see, but Monica just did a very cute pose when I said that. Of course, we have to talk about Midst, the Valorous Farmer. I am so excited about this project. I think that, you know, Monica and I both have questions about farms specifically. I'm going to start with, where are the cameras that you put on my farm? And why are you calling me out so publicly? I'm just kidding. But Hildebrand, I have Hildebrand's haircut. Like, I have Hildebrand's coveralls. I'm not even kidding. There is a part where Hildebrand is bent over, sort of like packing up their truck from like a farmer's market. And I showed my wife the panel and I was like, look, it's me. And she was like, yeah, that's literally, you have those pants. I was like, I know. But I think off mic, I shared with you all, you know, I turn the page and you see you and Aviv Orr show us the barn, but you show us from the back, not from the perspective Hildebrand is approaching the barn. So Hildebrand just sees like a normal barn and like opens the door. But we see a giant crystal has crashed into the barn. Hildebrand opens the barn and their face was my face when I opened my barn and found that my barn cats, had gotten fleas. So, you know, it's not like a crystal crashing my barn, but it felt very personal. And so I think it's so cool the way that you've nailed the farming experience in this book. And, you know, it's expensive, difficult. You're fighting with pests and broken down equipment. It's honestly, I felt like a tiny bit called out because our car was also broken down when I read it. It has since been fixed. But I was like, listen, why is Hildebrand living my nightmare that I am also living? You talked a little bit about this. I think off mic we talked about mm-hmm. this. So I'm basically making you tell our listeners. But, you know, why do you think farming is so good for this speculative setting? I know that part of it was the decision was with the folks because it's a work mm-hmm. for hire piece in the world of Midst, the podcast. But I'm curious, you know, what made you say, hell yeah, I want to do that farmer. I want to tell that farmer story. And why is it so good for specfic?
Yeah. And for me, several reasons. They came to me with a story and it was already going to be about a farmer who's struggling. It was going to be very kind of slice of life set in this wildly creative world that's got this like surreal horror vibes. And if you haven't listened to the podcast, it's absolutely incredible. Highly recommend. But it's very much like a mixture of slice of life and then these occasional moments of just buck wild nonsense happening. And this world is incredibly harsh. It's got this very strange ecosystem. Humans were not meant to live there. And a lot of it is this like bright white light and these crystals that float around that are just knife sharp. And it's just like, if they drift away, you got to go because it's not going to stop. And I was really intrigued by the idea of what would happen if you were trying to farm in this incredibly harsh, unforgiving environment. And as someone who, I'm not a farmer, but I did take several cultures in agriculture, like sustainable agriculture in particular. And so as soon as they told me it was going to be a farm story, I was like, oh my God, yes. So if you notice in the comic, Hildebrand has these like suspended sheets of this moss, because I was like, all right, what plant would grow in this environment? And I was like, something that really loves light, needs very little moisture, and can grow on some sort of grow support. And I was like, what if they have a specific kind of moss that they can dry out and turn into a flour that they can make bread with? It's very nutrient dense, because you're not going to get wheat. And I'm like, well, what are these people eating? And I love world building through food and agriculture. It's something I do a lot with my stories. I always like to ask, what are these people eating and how did they get it? And how does that work in this world? Some people like to focus on like big courtly politics, like architecture, things like that. I like to focus on food. That's what I got my degree in. And I love the process of it. So it was really, really fun for me to kind of tackle that problem. And me and the folks at Mist were in Dark Horse were going back and forth. And we had a big like video call. We discussed this and it was just a lot of fun because we were all just like so excited about this farming story. But yeah, it was a delight. It was a delight to work on.
I've always been mystified by the idea of being able to sustain my own, you know, food, space, et cetera. And I know that, you know, it's a privilege to be able to like own a farm, especially if you're not like a commercial farmer that mm-hmm. you like, you know, grow like loads of like trademark seeds and stuff like that. And I can't help but think about, and you know, this is just me being my analytical self, mm-hmm. about like how our own communities could possibly set out to gain that type of autonomy while also living on colonized land. And just like the prospect of like future space, like, you know, exploration. And I'm just curious, just from your own personal opinion, do you think that, you know, this comic is kind of like a wish for us to have like that space where we actually have control of the things that we need for sustenance, but also the things that we need to build like a community that's safe for everyone, mm-hmm. you know? So I'm just curious if it was like kind yeah. of like a fantasy element to it mm-hmm. that you have like your own personal wish to fulfill.
I think the very first thing about it is when you're talking about like self-sustained lifestyle, mm-hmm. there's this idea that you're like growing all of your own food, doing all of it yourself. That's not how it works. It's not sustainable. That's never how, it's never going to last. You have to have community. It only works with community. You can grow a few things as much as you can to supplement your own household. But the whole point is that you have a community of people all with different skill sets, doing different things that combine together to make it sustainable for everyone. And I feel like that's a part the majority of people miss. They're like, I'll do it all myself. And then they wonder why they have no time and no energy and it fails after a year because no one was ever meant to do it alone. Mm-hmm. We're not meant to do it. Humans have never survived. You can look back in history. You will never find a time where you have nothing but little single households entirely sustaining themselves. It's not possible and it's not meant to be possible. And I think that's something that is probably the biggest flaw that I see when it comes to like things like homesteading. Is people think they have to do it all themselves. And especially amidst, I wanted to lean into the idea of building that same community. Well, Hildebrand's, one of their main problems is that they're trying to do it all themselves. And what they really need to do is let themselves be part of a community and let some people take some of that load and let their friends help them out rather than relying on this structured system they've been sort of forced in since birth. That they've been told is the right way to do things and that, you know, good deeds and like, you know, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps is going to work out when clearly that's not how it's going to work. Like we as the outsiders are like, oh, wow, what are the flaws in that system? And I wanted to embrace the idea that rather than like cataloging your good deeds and working yourself to the bone, you can rely on this community where instead of having like every single one of your actions scrutinized, you are then a small part of a much bigger self-sustaining system that is healthier for everyone. And I think that's something that can be directly applied to real life. And I would love to see more of in speculative fiction because I feel like we focus so much on the big picture when we could definitely focus more on like the little pictures, the little details of people's lives and how they affect this larger ecosystem.
When I think about the search for self-sustaining, it's just so silly. Like you're both hitting the nail on the head. Like I live on a farm, I grow a ton of food, but I don't grow wheat. Why the hell? I don't have 40 acres. I don't have 7 horses. I don't even have a big tractor, you know? Like we're trying to do such a small scale thing, which again is a result absolutely of privilege, of my partner's privilege in particular. It's really changed my life, you know, to be able to do this work, but it takes money. It takes time. And I don't think it helps any of us to pretend that's not the case. I don't think all the people on YouTube talking about how great and easy their homestead life is really helping anybody, you know? No. I think there are people on YouTube doing great work. I think there are people who are really trying to teach people sustainable, affordable ways to grow your own food. And I do think we need that for the future. Mm-hmm. I think if we could teach people seed saving, oh baby, that's what we need. That's the lesson we need. I'm going to just go verbatim and just repeat all of Parable of the Sower. And I'll be like, that's what we need. You know, and you're all like, it's a good point. Someone else said it, but it's a good point. Sorry, tangent. But there's something so beautiful in taking a character in isolation who is self-imposing that isolation and not even fully cognizant that's what they're doing, right? Like they, part of them is feeling that isolation piece, but they also have that sort of... that like delusion that gets you through the day, which is like, maybe it won't break today. It's like, but you know, that's life. It's life when you're broke. It's life when you have unending expenses and fucking America, you know, it's like, that's how it is. But the scene where the person who comes to visit and she's fixing the car, I was so moved by just the sort of tender back and forth of like, you don't have to do it all alone. Like, your parents wouldn't want you to feel this way. And then to end the comic, you know, it starts so alone.
and so dialogue heavy in a good, and I mean that as a compliment. I don't mean it. I think it's actually a very artistic thing you pull off to start it with like that heavy sardonic narrative voice that's like, to everything Hildebrand is saying and doing. And then to end it with this series of panels that have very little dialogue, but really show people surrounding Hildebrand and offering an alternative vision to both your points of what the future could look like. That to me is one of my favorite kinds of stories, is taking the person who is alone and helping them grow through community. So paired with that narrative of going from isolation to community is this tension that it isn't the main story because, you know, what we're focusing on is that slice of life piece, but is really important, which is the farming for what we need, bread moss, aka food, and farming for what we'll sell, which in the world of midst is these fancy flowers, and the way that wealth, extraction, and capitalism have destroyed agriculture that predates any colonization, right? I always end up in fights with white people. I'm white. I mean that I end up with fights with white people specifically who farm, because white people specifically who farm like to have little stories they tell themselves about hunters and gatherers. And it's a lot of bullshit is what it is. It's a lot of fucking bullshit, because for millennia on this land where I sit in Vermont at this moment, Indigenous people have been cultivating various things through willow, blueberries. I mean, the list, pawpaw, maple trees, like the list goes on and on and on and on, right? And so when we think about how white supremacy, wealth extraction, capitalism have divorced us from our food chain, and then you also are pairing it with, in the world of midst, this sort of competing desire, do you grow the thing that will feed people? Do you grow the flowers that will sell? And you add it to this person in extreme isolation because of capitalism, at least in part, going back into community. I'm curious for you, what was the key of braiding those elements? How did you, because you're so good at it, Jasmine, I just want you to teach me, but how did you make sure that we have the conversation about the flowers, but it's never really on the page, right? We're never dealing with the flowers. I'm curious for you how you brought that all together.
That's something that I like to focus on. For me, narrative beats are so important. Pacing is like my bread and butter. It's my favorite thing to focus on. And I never want to info dump. I hate info dumping. I never want to do it. I've had editors be like, Jasmine, you need to explain this. And I'm like, we will get there. Trust your readers to understand that, like, if they go a few more pages, they will get more information. We don't need it all at once. I need enough to get you through the next few pages to get you where you need to be. And sometimes you don't need it at all. Sometimes you don't get to know what's happening in the world. And the way that I approach the flowers, and I discussed this with the folks, the MITS folks, I wanted to bring it up. I was like, what if we had this farmer who's farming this incredibly like critical crop that is now being phased out? Because what's selling are these beautiful but nutritionally useless flowers that the rich are buying up to eat so they can, so it looks fancy on their tables. Like, it's beautiful, but Hildebrand's like, all y'all against scurvy. I wanted it to feel like a conversation you would have. Like, I'll go to a friend's house and complain about the state of things without necessarily being like, this is how our government works. This is how farming works. Wow, it's almost like we have listeners that need to learn about our world. I wanted it to feel like a natural conversation. And it is a point of friction. As someone who works in this field, on this planet, I always find it to be a fun challenge to find out how much information to put into a scene, in a conversation, or visually. There's a whole long bit where Hildebrand is flying to the city, and as they're flying, you see the farms get bigger and more elaborate. They clearly have more money. And what you notice they're farming is these blooms, whereas the area Hildebrand's farm are small, neglected. Not so much neglected as they just don't have the funds to have these fancier farms. And they're growing the things that are actually critical, which I find to be definitely a bit of a parallel to the real world. But yeah, it's, for me, it's something I definitely intentionally try to do in each of my stories. I want to have that critical information from the world given to the readers bit by bit in a way that feels natural. So I hope that answers the question.
It answers, you know, it was a weird question. I was very excited. So it answers, I think, half of the question. I think the other half, I want to talk specifically about what you're saying about class. And I think I led you up to it and you like touched it a little, but can I just like poke you and say,
yeah,
talk about wealth and class more?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that is, I mean, I touch on it in Brooms as well, but in Mitt specifically, like it's a major part of the overall Mitt storytelling, this huge difference in class, what people have access to, especially when it comes to you, you're in this incredibly harsh world and there's a stark difference between the people with money. Well, no, there is no money in Mitt. That's the thing. There's valor. People with lots of valor, whether it is earned or inherited, which is key, especially in a world where you're supposed to be higher up in society, the more valorous you are. But if you've inherited that, what does that mean? That's something for people to ponder when they're listening to the podcast. But there are very clear, very, very clear class differences, especially when it comes to the kind of safety you can afford to have in this incredibly harsh world. If you can't afford to have a lot of it, life's really hard. You are in a place where the air is full of like, what is the equivalent of crushed glass? So just breathing there is detrimental to your survival. Whereas if you have a lot of valor, you get to live in these like sealed domes. You can have these fancy waterfalls that filter the air. Whereas you see Hildebrand's farm and their house just has like these cloth coverings for windows and like these battered sheets of metal to keep the worst of it away. And it's such a good visual indicator of that difference in class. And I like exploring that because I'm like, I would love to destroy the higher classes. I think people who are hideously rich shouldn't exist. Not that they need to die, but that it shouldn't be an option.
You're in the right podcast.
It shouldn't be an option. Like once you hit a certain amount of money where you are perfectly wealthy, you will be fine. Nothing will happen to you. There should be a cap where it's like, you literally can't use this money. Like
no.
In your lifetime, you couldn't waste this
money.
Not
possibly.
So at that point, at the point where the numbers stop making conceptual sense because they're so high, you should no longer be able to make money. You shouldn't be able to add to that. There should be a cap. Yep. And the rest should be spread among people.
Yep.
But yeah, so I love talking about class in ways that don't feel like I'm taking a hammer to the side of your head with it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like when a story feels like a moral brick is being thrown in your window. Mm. And I want it to feel easy to grasp. I don't think I'm a subtle writer at all, but I don't necessarily want to be. But I don't want it to feel like a PSA either. So, yeah.
Do you catch yourself leaning too far in one direction or the other when you're drafting?
I mean, sure, sometimes. Just depends on how I'm writing. I'll come back the next day and be like, maybe. I need to tone that down or crank it up.
Sure.
Yeah, and that's just part of drafting. That's, for me, anything I'm writing about will probably need a few rounds of edits where I feel happy.
You and me both.
The tone.
I'm like 2, 3, 26 drafts. Who's going to say? Depends on the piece, right?
Exactly.
And so fascinating how, you know, I think about our current world state right now and how a certain somebody is on track to become a trillionaire. A trillionaire, people. A trillionaire.
That's like, there's
that, no, like, that's absurd. That is absurd. Like, why does anyone possibly need much money? And I just think about, like, the struggles of, like, the Gilded Age and, like, how we are very clearly going back that route. Mm-hmm. But also just, like, the contrast of, like, you know, in agrarian society, having children was the standard because you needed to be able to work the land. And just like going back to community and like when I think about like the queer community, like there are kids that are a part of our community, but there's also people that just have chosen family and like mm-hmm. how community is redefined within that world and like how it also is the antithesis of individualism, mm-hmm. which is a byproduct of mercantilist capitalism. So I think that I definitely agree with you, like stories that are just filled with like a poli-sci like jargon and like stuff like that, it can definitely just like phase like readers out. But I think what you accomplished was by you infused like your own like views, but you did it in a very balanced way. You leave it up to the reader to make their own decisions and opinions of it, but also you leave it open for people to possibly do research. If they just like, you know, hear like a couple of things, mm-hmm. just like, I wonder if like, you know, if something just like makes sense, like, like you read a news article and you're just like, hold up, wait, I think a similar situation happened to miss. Let me just go back and just like figure out like if there's any correlation. And, you know, I feel like it is important for us to infuse like our own like experiences and our characters. It's not necessary, but I think it is like something that we do in order to flesh out our worlds, what we want to contain within our worlds and the messages that we want to put through. Do you see yourself, and this is outside of Miss, and this is actually going into us closing, but for any future projects, do you have any idea of like what topics you want to present in another world, or just like any other storylines that you feel you would be able to work with that could drive across many points?
Yeah, all the stories I like to work on tend to come with a lot of layers. Whether or not they're like super deep layers is a different issue. I'm never satisfied with like one message. Mm-hmm. And actually, there's a big project that I've been building out that I don't know when it will happen. It depends on my schedule and then if a publisher wants to pick it up or if I want to do it self-publish. But I'm working on this sprawling world with lots of short stories built in it about an alternate history in the United States. Because I think, and Brooms was an alternate history. However, mm-hmm. I was like, there's a bunch of cowards out there who don't take alternate histories far enough. You'll get stuff like, oh, what if there were vampires? Or what if this one thing changed? And I'm like, what if the transatlantic slave trade failed? What would the U.S. look like if colonization failed?
Sick.
And I want to make a Western. I love Westerns.
Oh my goodness.
I love Westerns, but I hate most Westerns.
Garbage.
Terrible. Yeah.
And garbage.
I want to make this sprawling world that is a Western in this alternate universe where what we know as the United States look like if slavery failed, if colonization failed, and about 200 years later, way more people from other places came to be like, what's this place look like now? And if indigenous people did keep their individual sovereignty across the country, and how do you negotiate between all these different nations? And the way that I want to focus on it, which is why I had so much fun with Mist, is through the agriculture. So that story is going to explore so many topics, but the main story that's focused on is about these people called seed runners. And what they do, their entire job is kind of like the Pony Express, except instead of mail, what their job is to deliver seeds from one place to another if someone is in need of them. Say there was a drought, there was a blight. Someone puts out a call and says, we are desperate for seeds before the planting season. Another community will say, we've got extras. And these seed runners take them from place to place. And I'm really excited to work on that story. I don't know when it'll be out, but I promise.
You'll be back. You'll be back when it's out because I brought up seed saving. Now you're talking. I'm like emotional. I'm like, oh, Jasmine, we have to talk a million more hours. Oh, that sounds really fun.
That's a really good concept. And I'm very excited to read that.
Awesome. So Jasmine, where can people find you online if they want to learn more?
Yeah. I mean, with the burning down of Twitter, it's definitely harder to find people. But I have my own website. It's my name. It's jasminewalls.com. You can always find all my projects on there. I keep it updated with all my newest things. If you want to find me on social media, however, I'm pretty much just on Blue Sky under MythJ, MythJae. And same username on Instagram. Those are the two places you'll find me on social media and like actually using it. Otherwise, the easiest way, if you occasionally want to check on updates, like what books are coming out, what books I've already published, if you want to see my other stuff and where to buy them, is going to be my website.
Fantastic. And listeners, if you didn't have a pencil out, because why would you? Don't worry, you can go check the show notes. I will have links to Jasmine's website and also where you can follow her on Blue Sky and Instagram. So you don't have to remember, Jasmine, you don't have to remember, just me. I have to remember. And I will, because I have a checklist I use for this. You know, Jasmine, I think we could have talked for another 4, 10, 30 hours. I mean, you are absolutely delightful. We didn't even get into your love of hot chocolate. We'll save it for next time.
Next time.
Next time we'll get into
it. Can talk about hot chocolate. Motivation.
Well, hey, if that gets you writing, baby, done. Done. We will make that happen. But you have been honestly just such a delight. Listeners won't know this, but we actually had some technical difficulties the first time we tried the interview. So it was kind of a take two, two-parter. But we fell right back into it so easily. You feel like you're one of the bitches now. And I hope that you will feel free to come back sometime. And also,
I hope so. Y'all are so nice. It was a delight being on the show.
Monica, you know I love you. Kate, you are like a god, except not quite as vindictive in at least, you know, most of the pantheons. And I'm grateful for you. I'm grateful for our listeners. Thanks for tuning in today. You know, this one was near and dear to my heart. I cried a couple times. I'm probably going to cry listening back to it. Patrons, I love you. Thank you for putting your little dollars in our little hands so we can keep this little podcast going. They're all little in my mind.
Yeah.
My hands are like a toy. I'm like a Barbie. I'm like, put your money in my hand. Oh, what a weirdo. But you must like me. You keep coming back. I don't know. There's got to be some appeal to this. Oy-vee. Okay. I love you all. Thank you so much, Jasmine.
Take care. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
You're listening to Bitches on Comics, distributed by Realm, your portal to another world. Listen away. Find more shows like Bitches on Comics by following Realm on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or at realm.fm.
Bitches on Comics is a bi-weekly podcast where we talk to your favorite comics and pop culture creators and critics about what matters to them in comics and pop culture, as you might have guessed. You can follow us on Blue Sky, Instagram, and TikTok at Bitches on Comics. You can sign up for our newsletter, listen to any of our episodes, find curated lists of where to start listening, read interviews available nowhere else, and learn about our other projects and upcoming appearances at bitchesoncomics.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by rating and reviewing us on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also buy us a coffee or send us a one-time morale boost at ko-fi.com/queerspec. That's ko-fi.com/queerspec.
You can also support the podcast by joining us on Patreon. Head to our Patreon page at patreon.com/queerspec to learn more.
I'm Essie Fleenor, and you can learn more about me at essiefleenor.com. You can find me on Blue Sky at essiefleenor. You know, the whole thing. And on Instagram at @Essie_Fleenor.
I'm Monica Estrella Negra, and you can find me at my website, Audrey's Revenge Film, listed below. Bitches on Comics is recorded by Kate Warner, who plays in the band Churchfire. You can find them at churchfiremusic.com. Our music is recorded by Katie Taylor, who plays as Earth Control Pill. You can find her music at earthcontrolpill.bandcamp.com.
If you like Bitches on Comics, you might also enjoy our narrative fiction podcast, Decoded Horror Channel, available wherever you get your podcasts or at decodedpride.com.
Be sure to check out our show notes to find a link to donate to campaigns engaged in important work.